The wheel of time turns and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Welcome to Dragon Mount, the Wheel of Time podcast. I'm Kathy Campbell.
I'm Rajiv Mote.
And I'm Maureen Carr.
Welcome to episode 2, Shadows Waiting.
It was directed by Uta Breiswitz. And it was written by Amanda Kate Schumann.
Fantastic. All right. I'm so glad that everyone gets to experience the first 3 episodes at once, because The second episode feels very much like Empire Strikes Back in the plot and the story. And I am so excited.
Yeah, it feels like the first 3 together make the first chapter.
Yes.
What I loved about this episode is it reminds me of the Fellowship of the Ring, the Mines of Moria, because the result of that scene was the party splitting up. Mm-hmm. Now we have multiple parallel threads that the characters are going through. So we're keeping track of multiple storylines, which is always cool. Because eventually there's going to be another convergence.
So this one opens with the White Cloak camp. And we see Eamon Valda, who is a questioner of the light. And just right away, he screams bad guy. And it's so funny, the juxtaposition of their white uniforms and the crystal clear meadow they're in. And the child is carrying like a fancy silver goblet, you know, and everything's nice and clean and beautiful. And then you see Valda and you're like, this man's the devil.
He is so reveling in this evil. He's so happy. Whatever that thing that he ate was. So it's a bird, I guess.
It reminds me of this dish that is called ortolan, and there was an episode of Hannibal that explored that. It's this dish that's so sinful to eat that you place a cloth over your eyes as you bite into it, because it's shameful to be eating this rich, terrible dish, which is basically a songbird drowned in liqueur and roasted, and you eat the whole thing, bones and all.
Well, that sounds like what this was, especially with the beak making him bleed, and it was so gross. But definitely like sets up that whole idea of how this is a bad guy, like plain and simple. You know that you don't like what he's doing, as witnessed by the horrible torture of the yellow Aes Sedai and the fact that he took her hands and is so happy with the torture.
He says brutality is the only path to mercy. Oh. And that's just like the worst statement ever. Like, he's just so missing the point of everything.
And he's gleeful about it. He is a spick and span gourmet who is laughing and spouting philosophy as he burns a woman at the stake. You know, I have to imagine that the actor was just gleefully hamming it up with this, because it was an amazingly evil scene.
Yeah, he just looks so happy to be there. And the beautiful film work, like the cinematography in this, was just incredible. I'd love to know how they did it, because the goblet that he drinks out of is flawless, and you don't see a camera there. So the fact that they had multiple areas of this scene close up with the goblet reflecting, you know, the burning Aes Sedai, and no camera in view, was just like, it was beautifully done. But you see, you know, the fingerprints of blood that Valda has left on the goblet, just like burning into your soul.
That was a gorgeous composition of evil and refinement.
And what a easy way to transition into the first time we've seen the credits. It was stunning.
So beautiful. Just the threads, you know, calling to mind the, what do they call it? Age lace, I think, is the term they use in the books, that each person's life is a thread in the tapestry that is the pattern. And it's just such a fantastic visual for it.
The dance of the threads through to weaving this beautiful picture of the seven Ajahs.
Yeah, when the images started, it looked very CGI to me. It kind of reminded me of the old X-Men and the old Spider-Man opening credits, which were a little lo-fi, but once the pattern starts to emerge, once the weavings of the Aes Sedai are shown, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, and mixed with the music.
The music's beautiful.
Major Game of Thrones meets Westworld just feels right. It feels epic, it feels fantasy, and it really is a great way to separate out, you know, the cold open with the rest of the story.
In this episode, we learn a lot more about what it means to be Aes Sedai. And I was particularly struck when Moiraine started to teach Egwene, and she uses the river metaphor for how to touch the power. And it calls directly back to Egwene's initiation in the Two Rivers. I thought that was really cool. And it wasn't an explicit callback, but you certainly have that imagery in your mind as you're watching this, especially back to back.
Yeah, the knowledge and, again, the storytelling aspect of this and the fact that Moiraine probably doesn't know the women's rituals in the Two Rivers, but she might. She knows about the braids. She knows about the age for that. And so it's plausible, but also she knows her own history. And being able to explain the channeling and the three oaths in this section is just really strong because it explains it to the viewer in a way that doesn't ever feel like, all right, students, let's sit down and let's have a conversation. I'm going to tell you all about channeling and how we do it. I love the teaching lessons that are brought into it in a really natural way.
Yeah, again, Moiraine is just so sympathetic. She's seeing a woman who lost her calling as a wisdom and is adrift, and she's giving her something to stand on.
Yeah. And doing it after having gotten stabbed by a Trolloc weapon.
Right. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, she's obviously not doing great. She's tired.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that Egwene recognizes when she gets mad later on at the boys for being the way that they are. It's just like, hey, pay attention. The power is not all seeing. There's limitations to this magic that they have. And it's powerful that Egwene recognized that she would have made an incredible wisdom instead. Mm-hmm. That's not her journey. And we don't know where that journey is going to lead, but by golly, they're going to work on keeping each other safe.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I really was interested in this episode. Is the first episode, we saw the One Power doing a whole bunch of things. It seemed like it was a limitless power. It could pull a rock slide down a mountain. It could throw fireballs. It could heal wounds. It could do all of these things. And now we're starting to learn that there are some rules to it. There are some limitations to it. The three oaths are limitations on all Aes Sedai. They can't heal themselves. Mm-hmm. But then Egwene also starts to get her education on what it means to live within the three oaths. And Moiraine even tells her that power inside you, that isn't your biggest strength. What your mind, the way you think, is going to be the thing that serves you the most. And now she starts to learn lessons like how to speak no word that is not true, but still tell a completely different story from the one people think they hear.
Yeah. So this running away, you can tell that the Trollocs are chasing them. Mm-hmm. This whole reason for them to leave the Two Rivers and Edmund's Field specifically is obvious because all of these Trollocs are coming to get them. They're traveling day and night to get away from evil that's chasing them. You feel the stress, especially this episode starting out with the calmness and serenity of the White Cloaks and then the beauty of the credits and then the terror of running the escape across the river. You learn more about the Trollocs. You learn what limits they have.
Yeah, so not only does... Mergal too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That gave me a real Game of Thrones hard home vibe where they're sailing away from the shore where all of the dead have been animated. We have just a small strip of water separating these characters that are fleeing from the two rivers, and there's this horde of monstrous creatures that's just across the river.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
The poor ferryman thinks that he can save his son, instead loses his life, and the torturous decision making again. Okay, episode one, we're laying the foundation, and now we're going to discover the holes in that foundation and the stuff that we didn't even think about wondering about as we start to expand this story, this world that we're living in, and kind of what's being told.
Mm-hmm. The ferryman yells, the white cloaks are right, you Aes Sedai are monsters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Moiraine is ruthless. She's using the power selectively because she has to be. We just learned that there are limitations to what she can do, and so she has to be selective in what she protects and what she leaves. And the poor ferryman is someone who has to be left. She can't save him.
Like you said, Rajiv, he says, the white cloaks are right, you're a monster, when there's actually legitimate monsters on the other side of the river.
Exactly.
And he jumps in regardless of the monsters on the other side.
Yeah, it just, oh my goodness, the decision making and the difficulty involved of poor Moiraine. And you see that, especially she's starting to get tired. Mm-hmm. The energy levels are dropping. You know that she's been injured, but you don't realize how bad yet. The effort to sink that ferry, too, you can see that it took a little bit more effort to weave that power than previously, and it's only going to get worse from here. But they do take a break. They finally rest. Mm-hmm. They're able to recover, but bad dreams.
I was going to say, it's not much of a rest when you have those kind of dreams. Well, dreams or... are they dreams? The bat that Rand pulls out of his mouth, he finds that when he wakes up, and then there are a lot more bats that are dead surrounding their camp. And then there's this new character, this new enemy, guy with embers for eyes. Very creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not creepy. Quite sure, awake or asleep, what's going on? This is a new kind of power that we haven't seen yet, something that doesn't seem related to what we've seen of the One Power.
But they immediately blame Moiraine, too, because they can tell this isn't normal. This isn't what we would expect to happen, especially when they learn that all of them had that dream.
Yeah.
And they're yelling at the Aes Sedai because, of course, it's got to be her fault.
And Moiraine is alarmed to learn this. She mm-hmm. knows more than she's letting on.
Yeah. It sets up the first inner group fight. You know, they had been following along, but the incident with the fairy and then with this dream sets off and kind of triggers this distrust. They're not just going to follow along like good little puppies. I think the stubbornness of the Edmondsfielders is coming alive. And there's some anger in there too between Rand and Egwene. And their relationship.
Well, Egwene has clearly chosen Moiraine to align with over him and his friends. And his questions were legitimate. He's got some backbone in this scene, which I love to see. Mm-hmm. He asks some real questions. And why should we trust you? What are we going to do next? What's the ultimate goal? And Moiraine still being mysterious. Yeah. She can't lie. So... she doesn't give an answer.
Yeah, I think when Moiraine sank the ferry, it brought to mind the idea of what's right, what's wrong. Yeah. I think that's what really shook Rand. Because it looks like he's the one that's balking the most. Perrin, like, I don't even think Perrin fights at all. He just is ready to do whatever. I think he's still, like, encased in his grief.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's Matt that convinces Rand to continue. So it's...
Oh,
it's,
he says, her lady does shoot fireballs, so right. Let's stay yes. on her good side.
Right.
I loved Matt right
yeah.
then.
He's got some good lines. Yeah, so I think Rand is the one that's being the most rebellious.
Yeah. I think it's personal for him too, right? Because of Egwene.
Yeah, so he's taking that heartbreak and he's internalizing mm-hmm. it and redirecting it.
And standing up against this powerful Aes Sedai mm-hmm. In a way that he seemed very amiable, very like low-key in the calm scenes, shall we say, of episode one. Coming in, this fire coming out of nowhere, standing up against, you know, the Aes Sedai, who's tired, and you know, having Egwene come out and be like, look, she's obviously taking care of us. She's healing our exhaustion, but she can't do it herself. Yeah. So
I'm going to go with this woman instead of the boar tusked monsters that are chasing us.
Yeah.
Okay, reasonable.
Yeah.
Well, even in episode one, after Moraine heals Tam, Grand doesn't even say thank you for saving his life. He immediately counters with, they didn't come until you came.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he just comes in ready to pummel her, despite her being this powerful woman, you know, that can bend him in half if she wanted to.
Yeah. But, you know, eventually they do leave. They're going to go and follow along. Somehow they quickly saddle up the horses and were able to leave super quickly. But hopefully Lan was like having some signs on where they were going in this field that they'd never visited. But that's fine. A little bit of a plausible deniability is okay.
Though a little tension now between Moraine and Lan. She didn't like where Lan was leading them. And of course that comes into play when we come close to Shadar Logoth. Shadows waiting.
Yeah, I loved the music in this bit, the traveling sounds when they're had this anger and they're going through and you're traveling. That's the main goal, is traveling, and it feels like travel until you get the white cloaks again.
But this encounter is quite different from what we saw of Valda. Like, we still see Valda, and he's still like an evil bastard.
Swarming.
But Bornhald is there too. Once he realizes Moraine is injured, he says, we don't like the Aes Sedai, but I suggest you find an Aes Sedai.
Yeah, and that floored me.
Yeah, me too. I was like, whoa, that's crazy that a white cloak would say that.
That's Valda is an outlier, maybe, among the white cloaks. They're not all like that. Or maybe is Bornhald just the good cop?
Yeah, but it's something that like has been presented as, oh, the white cloaks hate Aes Sedai and they cut off their hands and burn them at a stake at snack time. But clearly, the leader here is saying, oh my gosh, this injury is so bad. The only person that can heal it is an Aes Sedai. That is so poignant. And it'll be really interesting to see how that division is developed. Yet also the power that Valda has and the ability for them to like, oh, okay, I guess we got to check things because Valda wants to. Check things out. Okay, fine. I may be in charge. I've got the gold little arm thingy, so I'm in charge, but I guess you can come hang out too.
There's the military arm of the Children of Light under Bornhald, and then there's the Spanish Inquisition under Valda.
Gold versus silver.
The next scene after that is when they start singing the Song of Minethrin, and that made me tingle all over.
I can't wait to talk about it a little bit in the book section at the end of this episode, which, don't worry, anyone that's waiting to read the books or haven't read them yet, we will let you know when we are going to talk about spoilers through there. But the emotions in this scene, and I cannot wait to hear from somebody that has not read the books to see if that same feeling hits between the song and then the story time. It just was so meaningful to get a little bit more history in the area, but also the characters and the community that was built around this old city.
Moraine says, the old blood runs deep in you all.
Yes.
And that it's a good indication of where their inner strength comes from once we hear this story.
Yeah, that and being pushed off a cliff into water probably helps too.
Well, it goes back to what we've seen in the scenery so far. All of the ruins, all of these ancient ruins. There were civilizations before this, and they encountered cataclysms. We're hearing about it, one of those cataclysms now, the Trolloc Wars. You know, I think Moraine's speech could have been one of those info dump sections, but it came up as a, oh, you've got this old folk tradition. Let me tell you what it really means. And then the kids are thoughtful. They're kids. They're grown up now. But our Emmons Fielders are thoughtful about it. It gives them something to sort of ponder. They are part of something that reaches back through history and opposed the shadow in a way that none of them could dream of living in the farm.
Once again, the way that it's written to present this historical story and present this information on, oh, hey, this is the area. This is why we know the old blood runs deep. This is why the old blood is important, period. Having it done in this way, which means that it's part of the story. It's not just, all right, once again, teacher time. We're going to sit down and tell you what's happening. Not that there's anything wrong with teachers, of course. But when you're telling a story, it can be very jarring if exposition is just pulling you out of the narrative. It just fantastically done. You feel the emotions. You feel the information in a way that hopefully will stick around in what you're learning. It's a great transition scene, too.
Mm-hmm.
Transitioning in travel is always boring, but don't worry. Eventually, the traveling ends and it's break time. Egwene and Rand get to have a little bit of a reunion, calming down, getting to know each other. You know, Rand says, "I could never hate you," to Egwene, which was very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, especially he rebuffs her first when she comes to him when they're camping with the bats. But then after this, now he's willing to say, "No, I can't hate you. I can't ever hate you. I'm going to hold your hand.
Yeah.
I still care about you."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's forgiving not just her, but forgiving himself for the reaction that he had. Yeah. And it makes a little bit of sense. You know, he lost his mom. And his entire idea of what his world was going to be. But the bonds of friendship stay strong.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. He's bridging the gap between romantic to friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can be friends. Just give us time. And Perrin is hiding his wound.
Yeah. In many ways, not just the wound of killing his wife. Yes. Every time they talk about the Trollocs attacking and Nynaeve's and Layla's supposed death by Trolloc, it cuts to Perrin's emotional vibe on his face. And he can't tell anybody about either of the pains that are going on. And it's gonna get a little scary here.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then the wolves come and they lick Perrin's wound.
But oh my goodness, you can tell he's afraid.
Yes.
The very good puppers. Are just
they are
up.
Good dogs. Good dogs all around.
Yes.
Very pack leader mentality for the wolf to come over and lick the wounded.
Some foreshadowing that we know we can see. We can recognize it. There's some that we haven't seen yet, but this one is. And if only the wolves licking could fix Moraine, who is clearly getting sicker.
Mm-hmm. And despite her protests, Lyanne does eventually take them to Shadar Logoth. Yeah.
Well, it's helpful when, you know, Moraine is completely passed out. And
the chase was breakneck, too. The Trollocs are right on them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You got to do what you got to do. Thank goodness, you know, they woke up when they did. I can't imagine any less time to be able to get out there and going. And so scary, though, this... Perrin has to carry Moraine. Somehow they know where the city is.
No, he said to the east or something.
Like go to the city, but then leaves them to try and protect. Again, it doesn't matter. It's fine. You know, just plausible deniability. Look for the gigantic walls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that was so interesting. This was a city that was built with a wall with no gates.
Mm-hmm.
Completely insular, completely isolationist, and then inside it, some kind of an evil welled up and overwhelmed it. Now, that if that isn't a metaphor for something, I don't know what is.
We know from like articles and reading things that they've built this city for filming, and you can tell. Like
it was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely beautiful. You felt the deep, rotten... falling apart, corruption in this city in a way that was just so powerful.
Yeah, but also the past splendor, the architecture, the domes, the towers, the details on the facades were amazing. This was once a great city.
And now it's completely quiet. There was
no birds, no insects.
Yeah, no birds, no bugs, nothing. Oof, the Foley work, like the background noises have been so perfectly created that it makes this silence feel even more silent.
Yeah. It's very ominous.
Yes.
And then Matt said what I was thinking during this scene when Lan gives the exposition about what this place is. He says, that's probably more words than you've said in a day and maybe all your life.
Yeah. And but he's got to, because Maureen is, you know, still passed out. Someone has to tell him where they are, tell him what they're doing, what's going on. Tell them not to touch things.
Yeah, and of course Matt, being Matt, doesn't listen.
Well, it's almost like he wakes up in that dreamlike state that we saw earlier with the bat. There's something sinister happening that's playing with reality.
And the whispers that are heard, you know, again, it went from silence to very much not silent. The horses aren't happy.
Before that, though, we had Matt and Perrin talking about the knife Layla made. And we talked in episode one how Matt has this nurturing side that comes out. And I think it comes out right here when he gives Perrin Layla's knife and talks about how Layla made it for Matt, assuming Matt was going to be the one to get Perrin in trouble and would have to eventually save Perrin. And I think that was just a really touching scene, again, between Matt and Perrin.
Well, the words were strong, too. She said, to protect someone you love. Mm. And Matt loves Perrin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a fraternal love. But, you know, these two characters have a bond with each other. They're very good friends. They nurture each other. You're right.
Yeah. The friendship in all four with Egwene, too, is so strong. You can tell that they grew up together and they have that deep friendly filial love that isn't portrayed a lot on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really great to see how deeply and easily it's positioned here. Matt is presenting his emotions to Perrin by, oh, hey, this knife, you know, your wife made this for me, knowing that I would need to protect you. Let me give it to you. Mm-hmm. Like, let me share this story. Let me give it to you. And Perrin, in return, gives the only thing that he can do, which is the assurance that Matt's sisters will be taken care of.
Yeah. You know, we talked about how gender expectations are changed in the first episode. And they go against some of the stereotypes that we see in fantasy. I think that's exactly what enables this sort of like close nurturing friendship among men. You don't see a lot of that in fantasy of a certain era, and to see it here was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's touching. It's real. It feels good.
Yeah, the defining term of feeling real is so right on. Everything, these relationships feel real. They feel like, oh, hey, my buddy Matt. They feel like something is real going on. And I just love that.
Yeah, it was a great scene.
Less great, but also great, was Matt's discovery.
Yes.
You feel how evil this area is, but also don't touch things.
Mm-hmm.
Come on now. Mm-hmm. Don't touch things.
Matt touches the dagger.
Right after that, the horses get attacked, and all hell breaks loose.
Literally. Man, the shadow creeping and the complete dissolving of the horse into ash. Wow. That was so creepy and scary and unbelievably just, like, stressful.
I haven't feared for the lives of horses since watching The Walking Dead.
Yes. So. Yeah. But thank goodness it made Maureen wake up. Unfortunately, of course, it wasn't fast enough. And we're going to get some separation in the party.
Yeah.
Which anyone who's ever watched any sort of horror movie knows that's not a good thing.
Although with plots, that's also a way of, let's set up some new dynamics here.
Yes.
So we're going to see some deepening of relationships between characters that haven't interacted as much before, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to ask you, though. Matt gives away a dagger, and then he finds a dagger.
Mm-hmm.
Should we be reading into this?
Yes.
I mean, probably.
What should we be reading?
The wheel weaves as the wheel wills.
Yeah. I wonder if whatever was in Shadar Logoth basically plucked things from his mind, manifested something for him to take.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it saw an opportunity. He lost a dagger. He needs a dagger. And he just happens to find it. And that's what causes all this. Yes. We don't have a name for it yet, but that's what it is.
It was something given away in love, and this one is much more sinister.
Mm-hmm. Discovered in hate. So,
this strange symmetry that we'll find out.
Oof. The running away. So once again, you know, any sort of like high stress scene can be easy to miss what's going on, especially in the dark. I thought this was so well done. You could tell that they were running different directions. You could feel like, oh, this is exactly what's going on. Their journeys were very different. Matt and Rand with the door and the gate.
Boost me up. No, you boost me up.
I feel like
Matt is still Matt.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I feel like they've run away from things many times before.
Exactly.
They get the door open just in time. Perrin and Egwene head up. Which doesn't seem very smart, but you know what? That's fine. They make it until it's time for the water.
And at least two horses made it out, so I'm happy about that.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. Of course, Lan and Moiraine escape as well.
Yes. And then...
best part ever.
You know, I was watching and, you know, I know the books. I know who is involved in these scenes. But when I saw the knife at Lan's throat, I thought, who could sneak up on Lan? And just a split second later, I said, oh, I know. Yeah, okay, there we go. Mm-hmm. On screen. Nynaeve is back. And she is boss.
So angry. And what a way to end the episode. Mm-hmm. Holy
awesome
cow. Yeah. So powerful. You barely have a moment to breathe. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness there's another episode to come. But as of right now, I mean, you know that the rest of the people have made it out safely. And now you know Nynaeve is safe too. Mm. Which is just wonderful.
Still part of the pattern here.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Oh, goodness. Well, before we hop into the spoiler-ridden book area, I want to remind you all to visit dragonmount.com. You can find episode summaries if you want to get some more details of the show. You can also visit our YouTube channel, any of our social medias, to find some interactions and let us know what you think of this show and the show that we all just watched. And you can also visit patreon.com/dragamount to help support us and also get a couple little tidbits and some fun surprises that are only for Patreon members.
Excellent. So now we're going to talk about how these relate to the books. So the first episode took us through chapter 10 of The Eye of the World. Now we are going from chapter 11 to chapter 20, so another block of 10 chapters.
Ish.
Yeah. Not really. 9. Okay.
I love that we got to have more White Cloaks this early on. Bringing these characters into the story earlier means that the audience can get to know who they are. So it's less one note like the book is very much one story to start before it goes off into 8 million. And so I love getting a little hint of the White Cloaks and what they can do and how they are affecting the world. I thought was really, really interesting and bring some great potential in the future.
And the White Cloaks here, they're a real threat. They were never a threat to Aes Sedai really in the books, but here they start off, they come out of the gate burning an Aes Sedai at the stake, chopping off her hands and collecting trophies of the serpent rings. These are hardcore baddies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can tell Moiraine is not afraid, but is aware of the threat that they can present. In the books, it's always just like, oh, they're bothersome. We're trying to hide ourselves, but, you know, they're going to draw some fangs and torture some poor townsfolk, but they're not really a concern to us. Clearly, they're very much a concern.
This brings to mind, I think there's a quote in Harry Potter where Sirius Black says something about the world is not divided into good people and Death Eaters. In the books, it is very black and white. There's the light and there's the dark. And it's not till later that we see these other things come up, the evil of Shidar Logoth, the evil of the White Cloaks. And I like that we're getting all of that in this episode. So we get the male channeling too, as another form of evil or madness. It just gives it more depth.
Yeah, it's a deep, deep foundational series of lessons that are placed. Once again, the writing in this and the plot development mm-hmm. in ways that we can't even begin to understand is setting itself up for some really magical things to happen.
Yeah. And I'm wondering about the Aes Sedai, the Yellow Sister. How did they keep her from channeling?
Well, that's so interesting. Yeah, because they cut off her hands to stop her from weaving. I mean, we know in the books that doesn't stop them mm-hmm. from weaving, but it makes it more difficult because they do, when they learn gestures. Mm-hmm. And it's harder for them to do it without the gestures that they learned.
And so it's believable that, you know, you knock someone over or they somehow are able to surprise an Aes Sedai and then tie them up and cut mm-hmm. off their hands. Meaning, well, first off, you get a ring, but also they can't channel. And it'll be really interesting to see if that becomes a plot in the future. If that becomes an idea of, I don't know, Nynaeve or Egwene or someone else being able to channel without hands as a way to compete against the White Cloaks and whatever else might happen.
Maureen, you brought up Harry Potter before. I remember the towards the end when we learned that, you can cast spells without speaking. Mm-hmm. You can do it from silence. And that was sort of a new wrinkle in here. Maybe that deals with whether you need hands to channel.
Yeah, I was wondering if they were just bringing around like the fork root tea early. Like maybe the White Cloaks have this ability to dull a channeler's abilities. Yeah, because I don't think a Yellow Sister would sit there and let herself be burned. She would
not if she lit fire
to the ropes holding her or
right.
died fighting, not sit there meekly and let herself be burned.
Yeah, so something had to happen to have her be captured and tortured and killed. And obviously, Valda is very good at what he does when it comes to, you know, capturing Aes Sedai. But the difference between his idea of Aes Sedai and Bornhold's is so diverse and strong and really interesting to see where it comes in the future.
Yeah. I'm really interested to see how that develops.
You know, there was a scene where Moiraine washes the fatigue from the horses. And I thought, she's going to stop at Bela and say, hey, Bela doesn't need to be refreshed.
Yeah.
That didn't happen, of course. Nope. We missed Elias and Mordith and Bale Doman, fortune prick me. But it does make me wonder if Padan Fain, whom we have not seen since episode one, is going to be coming through and dealing with Shadar Logoth as well.
Yeah, and what that brings for the future. I completely trust the writers to tell this story. I can't wait to see how they've adjusted the story to fit the needs that they need to and what that means for the plot lines that we think we know, but clearly we have no idea.
The Fain Morda thing is something that could be streamlined out. We have an enemy. It's a formidable enemy. We probably don't have room for a different one. I liked Elias as a character, but it's interesting to watch Perrin kind of try and figure out and navigate what's going on with the wolves.
Yeah.
Especially since all we've seen so far is them not attacking him.
There was a piece of dialogue that was flat out foreshadowing from the books. When I saw it in the preview, it made me a little misty. Perrin asks, do you think we'll ever go back? And Egwene says, home? No.
Yeah.
And of course, for those two, Perrin does go back home.
Yeah.
Egwene, no, not at all.
At least in the book, she might in the show.
And I love not knowing. It makes it so much more exciting.
It does.
Especially watching this with people that haven't read the books. I can imagine answering questions that they might have. We have no idea. Honestly, and that's something
we're watching
so magical.
Fresh.
Yep.
There are rare opportunities to experience something you love for the first time again, and we're getting that.
Yes.
Love it. Mm-hmm. And we love all of you. And thank you for listening to this episode of Dragamount, the Wheel of Time podcast. We are so excited that you're along this journey. Come and hang out with us. And remember, this is not the ending, but it is an ending for this show. Thank you for listening. I'm Kathy.
I'm Rajiv.
And I'm Maureen.
Have a great day.